Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since the summer of 2014, oil prices have fallen by 70% from $107 a barrel to as low as $27. Some have compared the latest drop in oil prices to the crash of 1986, when falling oil prices were blamed on oversupply. But a lot has changed in the past 30 years. Climate change has forced many countries around the globe to seek alternative sources of energy and promote energy conservation, and fracking has pushed up U.S. oil production rankings to number 2 just after Saudi Arabia. Global production exceeds demand by more than 1 million barrels a day currently, and storage space is running out. Some analysts argue that OPEC's refusal to cut down oil production has also played a major role in the volatility of the oil market. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about oil prices and what they mean for the future of renewables and the energy sector. From Kern County to Saudi Arabia, people who rely on the oil industry will be greatly affected. What does this mean for them? Joining us today is Toby Jones, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University and author of Running Dry, Essays on Energy, Water, and the Environmental Crisis, and Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. And Toby Jones joins us from his office at Rutgers. Hi, Toby. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Great to be with you. Thank you.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by David Baker, staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, where he focuses on energy and clean technology. Hi, David. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. So, David, you have to leave us at 30 after. So what we will do is talk first about domestic issues, and then we will talk about what's happening overseas. They're very, very connected. But first off, David, I mean, this is very significant. A couple of headlines that I read earlier, Shell's profits decline 87% due to collapse in oil price. BP profit tumbles 91% amid the oil slump. Several companies have already gone bankrupt. And according to the New York Times, 250,000 oil workers have already lost their jobs. So this is huge, right?
This is a pretty gigantic shift compared to what we'd seen over the last 10 years. And, you know, we had for a while this era where oil prices just kept going up and up and up. That broke with the start of the Great Recession. But then after that, we had real stability in oil prices, where they seemed to be parked somewhere around $100 a barrel and just did not change. And that is what's happened now. We've dropped way out of that paradigm into this paradigm of very low prices, at least low historically. And everyone's looking to see what could possibly push that up. And nobody's seeing a real spike that I've heard of. No one's predicting a spike anytime this year. The question is whether or not it's going to reach equilibrium, whether the market's going to reach equilibrium this year and maybe start rising again later. But at the moment, it's hard to see it happening.
And Toby, what are your thoughts on the significance of this? Executives think it'll be many years before oil returns to $90 or $100 a barrel, if that happens at all.
Well, if there's one thing we know historically about oil markets, it's at least in the last two decades, it's that they're not stable, they're unpredictable. I think David's right that there's no indicator that in the short term prices will go back up. But it's hard to know what the major producers will do, how they'll measure their place in the market, whether demand will rise, whether production will be cut. There's lots of uncertainty all around, let alone the question of volatility and conflict in places where oil is produced in significant quantities. There's a lot that remains unknown, and we should probably just come to terms with that.
So let's talk about why this is happening, David. Many reports say that it boils down to the simple economics of supply and demand. You've got global production exceeding demand by more than 1 million barrels a day, and storage space is running out. Is that the main reason why this is happening, David?
Yeah, it's interesting in that for a long time in the oil market, there have been these eras where traders have sort of sold themselves on a particular story that will occasionally make them overlook some of the fundamentals, like just how much of the demand is needed out there. I think the most glaring example right before the start of the Great Recession, if you go back to when we hit the highest oil prices ever in mid-2008, and oil got up above $145 a barrel, at the point where we hit that peak, the U.S., the largest oil consumer in the world, was already starting to slow down and even show signs of falling apart, the U.S. economy. And yet, oil traders were so convinced that China could just slurp down every extra barrel that was out there on the market that they kept telling themselves, no, it doesn't matter that the U.S. demand is slowing down. That doesn't matter at all. China is what matters. And that story led them to basically overlook what was going on with the supply and demand balance in the U.S. What has happened now in the last 2 years is suddenly that myth of China being able to just suck down all the extra oil in the world, that has sort of evaporated. China is still growing in its oil use, but it's growing at a much slower pace than it was just a few years ago. It's still going up about 2.5% per year. But that's not enough to get rid of all the excess supply on the market.
Mm. Toby, what would you add to that? Is this really because of supply and demand, or is it more complicated?
Well, I think it's more complicated. I do think that the fundamentals matter. I mean, the bottom line is that there's more oil available. There always has been more oil available than there has been demand. It's a question of production rates and where it comes from and where it's available at any given moment. But the other thing I think that this underscores is, as David pointed out, expectations around China's rates of consumption as well as possibly South Asia's rates of consumption have always been pegged to a kind of fundamental belief that global capitalism operates in pursuit of unsustainable permanent growth, that there's always room for both production and consumption to go up continuously. Mm-hmm. And the reality over the last decade or so we've learned is that that's in fact not the case, and this is a mythology about the global political economic order. And oil is coming down from the sort of stratosphere in terms of prices as a result of that. But the broader lesson then is that our expectations about economic growth more generally are wildly out of proportion with how it actually operates.
Well, and also, I mean, what message does this send to citizens? Because you get these numbers in articles that U.S. drivers are saving $630 million a day compared to June 2014 because gas prices are coming down, which is about $1,000 a year. And Al Jazeera English interviewed a lot of drivers, and they said, this is great. I'm spending less money on gas. I'm driving more. I think I'm going to buy an SUV. So what is that due to the psyche of American citizens, Toby, about consumption?
Well, the primary concern would be that it reinforces an unhealthy dependency on fossil fuels and especially on oil for reasons of transportation and industry. I mean, you know, with the obvious potential cost of, you know, an ongoing commitment to a particular kind of pernicious instrument with respect to the climate and environmental damage. I mean, I think that's the thing that we should worry the most about, is that all the pressure that began to accumulate, say from 2003 when oil prices began their steady rise and, of course, their spike a few years ago, over $140 a barrel, is that there were calls for commitments to alternative energy. I don't think that those have necessarily diminished, at least not from sectors that are most committed to them. But for your average consumer, where is the pressure to do anything differently when the cost is so low?
What do you think about that, David?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, we've seen here in the Bay Area, we have probably the focal point of all electric car culture in the United States. We have more people who are interested in driving those than pretty much anywhere else in the country. And you do have people who are very much committed to changing the way they personally use energy. But if you're talking about the broad mainstream of American society, if gasoline is only costing them $1.70 a gallon, which is more or less what it's averaging around the country right now, a lot of people just are going to have a hard time caring.
Well, how do you deal with that? Because CNN had a piece in December showing that sales of the Prius is down 12%. Sales of the Volt, one of the first mass market plug-ins, is down 23%. But sales of SUVs is up. They're up 10%.
Yeah, SUV sales have been going up. The Volt is a little problematic because they had a huge switch between model years. They ended basically production of the first kind of Volt and replaced it with one that was much, much better. So, frankly, as soon as they announced that the next version of the car would get twice the battery range, everyone stopped buying it because if you were at all interested, you really was in your interest to wait 6 months and get the new one. But yeah, in general, we have seen very sluggish sales of plug-in cars to begin with, even before we had these low gasoline prices. I mean, the one saving grace that we've got on the popularity of trucks and SUVs resurging is that because the government has insisted on higher mileage standards, in part because of actions in California, even the SUVs now get a lot better mileage than they did 10 years ago. The example I like to cite is the Chevy Suburban, which is sort of like, you know, the prototypical SUV. That thing gets 23 miles on the highway right now, 23 miles per gallon, which doesn't sound like much, but 10 years ago it was 15. So there is a bit of a silver lining there.
That is David Baker. He's a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, where he writes about energy and these issues. And Toby Jones is associate professor of history at Rutgers University. Today we are talking about falling oil prices. What are your thoughts on this? And, you know, when you hear that oil prices are falling and the average family is saving about $1,000 a year because of these drops, what are your thoughts on how that affects people's their buying habits, for example? We've got SUV sales up and hybrids are now going down. And then we're also going to talk about how this is affecting companies and then people who rely on oil profits from Bakersfield to Saudi Arabia. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And also, what do you think this will mean for the future of renewables? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about how the fracking boom is affecting this. The United States is producing more oil than ever, largely because of fracking. Production has nearly doubled over the last couple of years, according to the New York Times, and this is pushing out oil imports that need to find another home. So, David, the Times reports that Saudi, Nigerian, and Algerian oil that once was sold in the United States is suddenly competing for Asian markets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been interesting to watch the fracking boom for years, in that we started to get this real surge in U.S. oil production for the first time in decades. And for a couple of years, it just could not make a dent in the price of oil on the world's market. We just stayed around $100 a barrel. And only within the last couple of years has that boom been so pronounced and just so obvious to everybody that it made a real difference in the price in the oil market. That said, you know, we are probably going to have less oil produced in the U.S. this year than we did last year. First year that we'll see a drop in, I think, the last 10. Because the price has gone down low enough that some of these wells are just not economical anymore. And that's why you're starting to see people losing jobs.
And Toby, what would you add to that?
Well, I think it's part of the broader calculation on the part of countries like Saudi Arabia and others who view what's, you know, called the shale revolution or the boom in fracking in the United States as a real danger or threat to their operations and their bottom line. There's been an attempt to read Saudi behavior, and particularly their refusal to cut production and raise prices or to steer OPEC in that direction, as an effort to kill off the fracking industry in the United States. It hasn't worked, and it hasn't worked for a lot of reasons. It's unclear what the sort of 3 to 5 year time horizon will look like. But it has also perceptions of resurging American strength with respect to oil production has also frightened especially Middle Eastern producers.
Can you elaborate on this? Because according to reports, Iran, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Algeria have been pressing Saudi Arabia to cut production to firm up prices. But Saudi Arabia and other Gulf allies are refusing to do this. Can you elaborate on why that's happening?
Well, the way oil works in all of these places, of course, is very different than the way it works in the U.S. economy. They're almost all completely dependent on those states in the global south, you know, the ones that you named, led by Saudi Arabia, are almost entirely dependent on oil for the health of their domestic national economies. And so the price of oil has either a positive impact or a negative impact on how they're able to do business. And it's especially important for reasons I think we'll probably get into later on the nature of political systems in those places.
Right.
Saudi Arabia is especially important because it's largely been understood to be, if not the largest producer in the world, right now the U.S. is roughly on par with Saudi in terms of annual production, as the most important, because the Saudis sit on what's called a spare capacity. They leave a significant amount of oil in the ground every year, and they can ramp up production or they can cut production pretty much as they like, and you know, and of course, talking about fundamentals, that has an obvious impact on whether prices are high or low. So their refusal to cut prices creates all kinds of political problems for places like Iran, and is interpreted as having an effect in keeping prices low.
Let's go to a caller on the issue of oil prices. Let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show. Hello, Ruthann. Did we lose Ruthann? Ruthann said she thought Venezuela was the largest oil producer, not Saudi Arabia. Where does Venezuela fit in this equation? Toby, do you want to take that?
Yeah, Venezuela is one of the large global producers. I mean, think in terms of raw numbers, the Saudis, the Russians, the Americans all produce similar quantities. Of course, there's a difference in terms of how important one is versus the other. Even though the U.S. is a large producer, it still imports a significant amount of oil. The Saudis produce oil almost entirely for export, although that has also changed in the last two decades. The Venezuelans are in a similar position to the Saudis, where they mostly export their oil, and so they need to generate as much profit as possible from that. They're one of the big global producers, but they're not the largest.
Well, thank you for the call, Ruthann. David, I know you have to leave us in about 5 minutes, so let's talk about how this is going to affect places like Alaska, North Dakota, Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. They're all facing major economic challenges, and the LA Times had a really interesting story about how this is going to hit Bakersfield. Because, not sure if people know about this, but Bakersfield and the rest of Kern County produce more oil than any other county in the country, not in Texas or North Dakota, but Bakersfield. And the story was really interesting, looking at how it's hitting high-level executives. They're not hanging out at the expensive restaurants like they used to, but it's also hitting the local diner because people aren't eating out as much as they used to.
Yeah, I don't... Being based in the Bay Area, I don't get to go down to Bakersfield all that often, but I have spent some time down there, and you know, the county's reputation is absolutely true. It is two things. It is ag and oil, usually with the two industries cooperating with each other. But Kern County is California's oil patch. It's part of the culture there. It's the big driver of jobs there. And yes, the county's fortunes swing up and down every time the price of oil changes dramatically. They have had a boom over the last few years. Basically, they sit on some old oil fields that have been in production for 100 years but still have plenty of oil in them. And whenever the price is high, it's economical to pump as much of that stuff out as you can. When the price starts dropping, some of it is not economical to go after. So production revs down, and suddenly there are fewer jobs. I think the LA Times counted in that story something like an 18% drop year over year in employment in the oil sector in Kern County, if you're looking at December to December figures. So, yeah, they're going to be hurting for a while. And California as a state is not as dependent on oil as some of those others that you mentioned. So we've got a pretty diversified economy. We're still going strong. But this is going to be a bad time in Alaska. It is going to be a bad time in Louisiana, definitely North Dakota. Texas is pretty diversified, but they're going to hurt too.
And it also affects their tax base because, for example, in Kern County, they saw a 9% decrease in their assessed value of property, which affects the school districts, government jobs, for example. Do you feel like environmental groups are reaching out to these communities to have conversations about how to transform from an oil economy to a green economy, and you know how they're going to create green jobs in the future?
It is entirely possible that those conversations are going on, and I just haven't heard about it, but I haven't heard about it.
It seems like that needs to be done.
It does definitely seem like a logical thing to do, but you know, It's taken a lot of years for people to realize that we need to have that conversation just around coal in Appalachia. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've gotten to the point where people are realizing, oh, we have to have that conversation in oil areas too.
Toby, is this something that you look at?
Well, I think what's so frightening here to think about is that there's a sunk cost in the sense that across the West, especially California, but also the Dakotas, Colorado, Wyoming, as well as New Mexico and elsewhere, in which the oil industry has invested so heavily and created certain kinds of opportunities for employment that don't exist more broadly in the economy, right? The people flock to high-paying jobs in a vulnerable but lucrative industry. I mean, the broader problem here is that those are the only great jobs that are available for a large number of folks. And it creates a kind of cycle of dependency. It's not good for the climate. It's not good for the economy. It reflects lots of underlying problems.
Right. We saw that after the BP oil disaster in the Gulf.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, we sort of block off the environmental and other costs because we tend to think, and I think rightly so, about the impact of people on their livelihoods, on the social cost of all of this. But really, it's a catch-22 that if we weren't so dependent on the oil industry for work and otherwise, then there might be other opportunities that could be encouraged or created.
David, where are you looking to now in terms of where this is going? What's the next story here?
In terms of the effects of the oil price drop?
Yes.
Well, I am very keen to see exactly how this does affect the growth of renewable power and alternative sources of energy, and that you've got two things going in opposite directions right now. I think despite the fact that the Republican Party is still officially against doing anything on climate, the fact that we just had this big accord in Paris is going to start ratcheting up pressure all around the world to really take serious steps to cut fossil fuel use. And that's going to be coming from the government end of things. But, you know, if you've got low prices for gasoline, for oil and gasoline, consumers may not have that same drive to do their part in it. So I'm not sure how those two things, that it's going to be sort of a push and pull situation, and I really don't know how those two things are going to balance out. You do have a lot of people who are ready and willing to take action in their personal lives, but by and large, that's sort of like a vanguard. It's not a huge, I wouldn't say it's a majority of Americans yet. And for the majority out there, I don't know that they're going to feel terribly concerned about, you know, buying a Prius, buying a Volt or something like that, if they don't have to, or if they don't see an obvious paycheck kind of a payback for themselves.
And then what about the oil companies? Because they're losing major money, and as a result, they are stopping various projects around the world because they're so expensive.
Yeah, I say this as someone who belongs to an industry that has been thoroughly disrupted, but, you know, we could be talking about a serious disruption here where a lot of people lose the jobs that they had and aren't going to get them back in the near future and have to find something else. And it kind of angers me whenever I hear economists talk about creative disruption in the economy and, oh, we can, you know, grow this sector of employment when this other one dies. For the people who actually get dislocated, it's a terrible experience. And I fear that in places like Bakersfield and Kern County, you're going to have a lot of people who the jobs that they've known are just not going to be there in the numbers that they need, and they're going to have to come up with a plan B. And that's always so much easier said than done.
Wow. I mean, last month, BP says it's going to cut 4,000 jobs this year. It said it would trim 3,000 from its marketing department by the end of 2017. So it looks like this is just going to continue.
Yeah. About 10 years ago, I actually spent a couple days on an offshore drilling rig out in the Gulf of Mexico before the BP spill. And, you know, I interviewed as many people out there as I could and just sort of talked to them about the work they did. And for a lot of these guys, the ones who aren't even trained engineers, this kind of work was the best paying job that they could possibly hope to get.
Wow.
And, you know, if it evaporates out from underneath them, what do you do?
Yeah. And before we let you go, David, I wanted to ask you just quickly about Congress lifting the 40-year ban on exporting oil. It was part of the $1.1 trillion spending bill. And Democrats decided that in order to get tax credits for renewable energy sources like wind and solar, lifting the ban was worth it. CNN says it started slowly, and so far U.S. oil is being shipped to Europe. What do you think we'll see there?
Well, in the end, I don't really think it's going to make a huge difference so long as we're still using more oil than we produce. As Toby mentioned, we're still a net importer. And as long as that's the case, yeah, we're going to see some exports here and there where it's beneficial for one company or another, but I don't think we're going to see a flood of oil pouring out of the U.S. into other places.
And so do you think as prices come down, the U.S. citizens are going to use more oil?
Yeah, they will, although the efficiency gains that are getting sort of built into the economy by having higher fuel standards for cars and also other kinds of efficiency, you know, for for electricity. Obviously, that's not oil. It doesn't affect oil as much as other fossil fuels. But I do think we'll see a bit more oil use in the U.S., but I don't think we'll see a boom simply because the machines that we have that use oil are much more efficient than they used to be.
David Baker is a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, where he covers energy and clean technology. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And sticking around for the rest of the hour is Toby Jones, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University. And when we come back, we will talk about countries like Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Iran, and then also smaller countries. They're going to be hit really hard: Venezuela, Nigeria, Ecuador, and Brazil. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll find links related to today's show. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock, it's Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Story about prisons for migrants. 12 noon brings us Backstory with the History Guys. Today, a history of advertising in America. Reveal at 11 and Backstory at 12 noon here on KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about efforts to oust the California Coastal Commission's Executive Director, Charles Lester. Four commissioners who want Lester out are not talking publicly, but insiders cite his management style. 35 former commission members and 76 environmental groups are defending Lester. They're calling the move a power grab by pro-development forces. There will be a public hearing on this in Morro Bay, which is down south on Wednesday. We'll talk tomorrow about why this is happening, what's behind the shakeup, and who should decide the future of California's coastline. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the massive, massive drop in oil prices. Just since the summer of 2014, oil prices have fallen by 70%, from about $107 a barrel to as low as $27. And you have seen major hits to oil companies. Shell's profits declined 87%. BP profits tumbled 91%. So many people are losing their jobs. So far, 250,000 oil workers have lost their jobs. We're talking about why this is happening, what does this mean for the future of oil, and what does this mean for the future of clean energy and renewables. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. When you see oil prices going down, how does this shape the way that you drive, your buying purchases? What are your thoughts on that also? Today we're joined by Toby Jones, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University and author of Running Dry: Essays on Energy, Water, and the Environmental Crisis. He's also author of Desert Kingdom: How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. So, Toby, let's talk about Saudi Arabia, because this is fascinating. Saudi Arabia is the world's largest oil producer. Oil revenues, do they account for 90% of government income or 70%? I've seen both numbers and reports.
Yeah, it's it tends towards the higher side. I think the official estimate, well, there's no official estimate. I think Aramco, the state-owned oil company, probably generates around 70% of the kingdom's total income annually. But then derivative industries, whether they're hydrocarbons or petrochemicals, which make up another large sector, but still all totally derivative from oil, also kick in 20 or so percent to the domestic economy. So oil and its products generate overwhelmingly the vast majority of income that Saudi Arabia gets on an annual basis.
And CNN had a really interesting rundown of government programs in Saudi Arabia: free health care, free education, citizens pay no tax on income, interest, or stocks. Oil is really cheap there for obvious reasons. The electricity is really cheap. Can you talk about how the Arab Spring affected these subsidies and what the Saudi government gives to its citizens?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the roots of this are, you know, back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, as oil prices began to rise largely around the energy crisis, or at least what was perceived to be an energy crisis in 73, 74, Saudi Arabia rapidly ramped up its commitment to what all of us would consider a social welfare state, and provides cradle-to-grave services, heavy subsidies on everything from food to water to electricity to education and health care. And that's mostly remained in place ever since. If you think of this in sort of stark political terms, I mean, the basic contract is this. The state says, and here we're talking about the royal family, the Al Saud, the sort of oligopoly that controls the kingdom, says that in exchange for all of those services, you can have no political rights. There's no free speech, there's no assembly, there's no voting, there's no real participation in the system. And to criticize the government comes with a pretty heavy consequence, going to jail, being tortured, all kinds of nasty things that happen. All of this came under pressure at various moments historically, but especially in 2011 with the Arab uprisings, when it looked like there was a wave of democratic mobilization across the region. And the Saudis panicked. They believed that there was evidence in Egypt and Tunisia, Yemen and Bahrain, that citizens were restive, and they were no longer happy with the status quo. And the Saudis responded, not by opening up the political system, but by doubling down on those subsidies, throwing even more money at the cost of maintaining that political contract. And now that we see oil prices declining, that very contract comes under pressure because all of those things become unaffordable and unsustainable.
And according to The Telegraph, workers and pensioners in Saudi Arabia got a $32 billion bonus after the Arab Spring.
Yeah, King Abdullah announced tens of billions of dollars in new spending. And of course, it's no surprise that that some of that money would have been directed for purposes that weren't quite as good as, say, improved health care or education.
And how is this money doled out? I mean, other than citizens who, say, for example, are struggling in Saudi Arabia, how is this doled out to the monarch and the princes? How does that process work?
Well,
the royal family.
Well, this is this sort of demands or requires, in order to say with any confidence, it requires the kind of a level of criminology or ability to know what goes on inside the palace than most of us have access to. I mean, this is sort of a basic way to think about it, right? That the state is controlled at least at the highest level by senior members of the royal family, right? And so it's a family business. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is a family business. And they occupy all the top positions of power and privilege, and then, of course, their influence trickles down through institutions and ministries and all of that stuff. The central place where oil revenues accumulate is in the treasury, and I mean, we might as well assume that there's a checkbook for the family, and they write themselves a monthly or an annual subsidy. Mm-hmm. They borrow quite liberally from it, but they see it as a personal bank. And that's how they behave around it. What the actual instruments of distribution are, I'm not really sure. But in some ways it doesn't really matter because they've orchestrated and organized it in a way to serve themselves first.
And then they're spending so much on the military. They're completely reliant on imported weapons. They are fifth place in military spending. They've launched a brutal assault on the Houthis in Yemen. It's very costly. So if you couple that with these programs that they're now offering their citizens, I mean, how long can this last?
I would hesitate to say it can't last. I mean, let's reframe the question. It's lasted for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. So how did it come? How did this come to be a way that Saudi leaders saw it as sustainable in the first place? It's always been expensive. And until 2003 or 2004, oil prices were not particularly high. They began to rise after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Whether it's sustainable going forward is an entirely different question, but it's a question that's changed a little bit as a result of some political and demographic realities in the kingdom that they weren't confronted with even 15 or 20 years ago. One is that the kingdom has enjoyed population growth. So one of the things that distinguishes Saudi Arabia from a place like Iran or Venezuela or even Iraq is that Saudi Arabia has a comparatively small population. So subsidizing the cost of a cradle-to-grave social welfare state isn't as expensive as a place like Iran, which has three times or twice the population of Saudi Arabia and less oil to generate. But we're seeing some of that change. There's population growth in Saudi Arabia. Over the last generation or so, there's been a large number of expatriates who come into the kingdom to work. So now we're looking at 35 million people, all of whom exert a certain amount of pressure on the state. It's also the case, and I wrote about this in my first book, that Saudi Arabia doesn't have any natural sources of water that are reliable for long term. So they generate their own fresh water by desalinating seawater, and that's incredibly expensive. It also requires a lot of their own oil. oil that can't be sold on the market to fuel. So there are lots of internal contradictions that have become apparent in the last 10 or 15 years that are different and they're more urgent for the Saudis. So I think those questions about sustainability are especially relevant now. And the bottom line is the Saudis don't have an answer. They don't know how to get their way out of it, how to find their way out of this.
It's interesting you bring up oil, Toby, because we're still in a major, major drought here in California. And last month, Reuters had a really interesting piece about Saudi Arabia's Al Mari company. It's the largest dairy company in the Gulf. And it spent almost $32 million to buy land in California to supply its businesses with alfalfa hay. So they don't have, like you said, water and land over there, and so they're growing alfalfa here in California, and then they're sending it to the Gulf to feed to cows for dairy.
Yeah, it's what a lot of people refer to as virtual water. The Saudis don't have their own water, or at least they don't have the kind of water that they made available through expensive technologies in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, so they go find it elsewhere. California is one place where they're buying virtual water. Ethiopia, Sudan, parts of Egypt, also parts of Central Asia. In those places, it's especially interesting and pernicious because they end up dislodging lots of local cultivators and indigenous communities from land that would otherwise be theirs. Mm. And let's face it, they're not exactly sustainable. I mean, there's a huge environmental cost.
Huge. Now, before we move on from Saudi Arabia, what about the people? I mean, Saudi Arabia offered these subsidies to its people to quiet them down during the Arab Spring. What is the status of social movements inside Saudi Arabia?
Well, Saudi Arabia is an incredibly complicated place. I mean, it's large. If we just take a look at the map, it's one-third the size of the United States, so it's a big place. And there are disparate ways of thinking. There are disparate groups. I mean, it's not homogenous. We often like to claim that Saudi Arabia is a conservative place beholden to a particular kind of austere version of Islam. And the reality is it's a lot more complicated and complex. There is not necessarily an underlying widespread base of social support for the royal family, but there's an accommodation, and that is that even if Saudis don't particularly adore the government or the state, they fear the alternative, and many of them are comfortable with the kind of reward or social services that are being provided to them. I think if there were cracks in the Saudi armor, we might see the emergence of social movements there. But the reality is that people are content with the status quo because they see Syria, they see Yemen, they see Egypt and these other places, and they fear those as potential outcomes. Mm. And the last thing I would say about it is that if you want to know what a civil war would look like in Saudi Arabia, let's say there was a significant movement of protest against the state that could generate popular support in a province or in a city or somewhere else, look no further than Syria. The Saudis are brutal. They're coercive. This is a state that relies overwhelmingly on police power and the threat of violence against their own citizens. Just consider what they did against these 47 men in January, beheading.
Right. I'm speaking today with Toby Jones. He is associate professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Today we are talking about the massive decline in oil prices. We have a question about Saudi Arabia from Rob, who says, is Saudi Arabia and OPEC trying to break the Russian oil industry?
Yeah, I think the Saudis and OPEC are able to sort of hold together or entertain multiple objectives at one time. And, part of that is to do as much damage as they can to the Russian oil industry. Part of it is to do damage to the American fracking boom, the shale industry. Part of it is competition between them. Part of that is kind of seeing Iran as a rival, even though Iran is part of OPEC. That's all part of the calculation. All of those things, I think, are thoughts that cross the minds of policymakers and sort of the architects of OPEC strategy. But the other part of it is a real fear that they no longer can control the global oil market in a way that they at least believed they could in the past. The reality is that Saudi Arabia was significantly hit and unable to produce oil, that they would lose market share. There are other producers out there that are willing to make up the shortfall. And that can at least come together and behave in a certain way. So the real question is whether or not OPEC has the power to change their behavior, whether they're operating in a position of strength or a position of weakness. And I happen to believe that more recently they're operating from a position of weakness, and that maybe they're not trying to destroy anything, they're just trying to preserve their own position.
How do you think the drop in oil prices will affect Russia? According to reports, the Russian government is planning to raise taxes and cut social safety nets.
Yeah, we see a similar pattern for all oil states. I mean, Saudi. I think that the most obvious consequence from Russia to Saudi Arabia to Kuwait to Venezuela and elsewhere is a move back toward autocratic politics and sort of a heightened kind of authoritarianism in these places, which often comes as a consequence of having to cut certain social welfare programs and rolling back, to the extent they exist, any kind of liberties in those places. So as states like that have to make painful cuts, they also become a bit more brutal in how they handle their own people.
Mm. Well, and also, according to reports, there's a lot of competition happening now. You've got Russia, Saudi Arabia, and producers in North Africa like Nigeria. They're taking part in a battle to maintain their market share.
Yeah, and with Iran now, you know, in the post-sanctions era, or at least mostly in the post-sanctions era, you're looking at the possibility of even more oil coming onto the market. And, of course, there's long been speculation that post-2011 that Iraq's oil will also come onto the market in significant quantities. And so I think that that's probably the overriding imperative on the part of the Saudis and the Russians and others, and that is not to cut prices and not to, or at least not to cut production so that they don't lose their foothold in the market, because they could be outmaneuvered in ways that they couldn't 30 or 40 years ago.
And what about Iran? How is Iran being affected by this?
Well, Iran, you know, I mean, they're sort of now looking at the possibility of being fully integrated into the global market. Their oil will come available in quantities that they haven't enjoyed in quite a long time. I also think there's something we mentioned earlier about the sort of the move away, at least on the part of domestic consumers, from Saudi and Nigerian and other oil. The reality is most of the oil that's produced in the Gulf doesn't come to the U.S. I mean, I think maybe at the height around 20% of American consumption of foreign oil came from Saudi Arabia and Gulf OPEC producers. But the reality is closer to 10, 12% historically. Iran will now begin competing for markets in Europe and in Asia and in parts of Africa with Saudi and with other regional producers. And it's going to be very interesting to watch to see how they behave.
Rob also wants you to talk about how declining oil prices might break the economies of the third world nations whose main or only export is oil.
Yeah, it's a significant risk for them. To be oil dependent means that not only that social welfare, things like that we've talked about, the services that states provide, but also the possibility of employment and work, and so the ability to earn an income. And we talked about California and North Dakota and Colorado and a quarter of a million jobs lost as a result of declining production and declining fracking. Similar things will happen as oil revenues begin to dry up in places like Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. And this means that there's pressure on the state. You know, Saudi Arabia 5 years ago, 6 years ago, already faced two significant social problems that were a consequence of its inability to manage oil revenues and to find its way to a kind of a post-oil economy. And those two significant issues were extremely high unemployment amongst young men and women between 15 and 40. So upwards of 30 to 35% of people in that age category don't have jobs already. So they're entirely reliant on the state. And that's a huge problem if there are declining revenues, because there will be no specter or no possibility for them to get work in the future. And that can lead to social pressure. It can lead to other costs that the state can't meet. The other significant measure is that even according to Saudi Arabia's own Ministry of Labor, upwards of 3 million Saudis live below the Saudi Arabia's poverty line. That is to say, there's up to 3 million people in the kingdom, now maybe 8 to 10% of the population, who don't meet the bare minimum for living day to day, which is another huge problem, not just from a humanitarian perspective, but also as a political one.
Rob, your final question about why California gas is more expensive than the rest of the country. According to Forbes, we've got a bunch of taxes in California. We pay a state tax at the pump, a sales tax, and then an excise tax. So it's a set amount per gallon, a percentage of the price, and then we've got cleaner burning, which is reformulated. It reformulates the gas, and that requires more processing and costs an extra 5 to 15 cents a gallon to produce. Toby, do you think the prices will keep coming down? We have a few people asking that question.
I have no idea. I'm the worst person to ask to speculate. I mean, I often do this, right? I dodge that kind of question because I'm a historian. The reality is we don't know. I mean, I think that in the short term, prices will probably remain relatively stable. As we get into the spring and summer, it's hard to know. Driving season goes up. Will demand rise? Will there be shifts in global industry and production that requires more? Or will people cut use? It's impossible to say. I think David raised an interesting question earlier, and that is that are we actually going to return to something closer to an equilibrium where prices go back closer to $40, $45 a barrel, which seems like where they probably should be? My guess is they'd go in that direction rather than going down any further.
Toby Jones is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers, author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia and Running Dry. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for those questions, Rob. And let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show. Hello, Greg.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
I had a question for you, which is related to climate change, and I'm just wondering how your guest feels this drop in oil prices might have some impact on what seems to be the incredible denial that we're all living in about climate change and the fact that it's happening faster than it is. So I'm just wondering how you would see some change, if possible, coming from this with regard to movement toward trying to deal with climate change.
Toby, were you able to hear Greg?
I thought I heard part of it. Unfortunately, I think Greg cut out. But the basic question is, what is the cost of low prices on our politics around the climate? Is that
right? And now that we know that Exxon knew about climate change back in the 70s, and according to Inside Climate News, other oil companies also did, and yet kept it from the public. How do you see this affecting climate change going forward?
Let me take on both of those. On the question of Exxon's knowledge and awareness of all of this, it's much like Big Tobacco in the 20th century, fully aware, according to their own scientific research, about the consequences of nicotine addiction and its cancer and carcinogenic qualities. Of course, the energy companies have known all of this. I think what's more disturbing than giant global corporations being driven by greed and profit is that the American state, from Jimmy Carter through Ronald Reagan, engineered a political framework in which big energy came to be seen as an industry that was too big to fail, and supported it through all kinds of concessions and subsidies that allowed it to flourish rather than challenging it to think, sort of critically about its operations with respect to the environment, but also public health more broadly. I mean, so one of the questions we have to ask ourselves about ExxonMobil is, to what extent is the state and the U.S. government complicit in all of this, and how do we undo it?
Mm.
The question on the climate is that this is my biggest fear, that we'll become, accustomed again to low prices. And that in the short term, that we won't think critically about what the long-term consequences. There's all kinds of familiarity and awareness that we're really past the tipping point. If that's not enough to mobilize us to action and to think and make hard choices about oil, I'm not sure what it's going to take. The reality is we don't see much support. We see more environmental apathy than we do really mass mobilization around questions of the climate.
Well, in a related question or comment, April says the oil industry and its investors should retool, invest in alternative, if not clean, energy, retrain workers, just as car manufacturing has had to retool to produce more efficient and alternative energy use cars. The oil industry needs to change their business models, and it's fantastic that Alaska potentially will not be ravaged by the oil industry. Thanks for that, April. George says, what is the impact of wind and solar on fossil futures? News quotes do show steep decreases per barrel of oil, but we see overall adoptions of alternative power production at the same time. What has to happen to reflect this simple fact in the energy calculus reported in the daily news mix? Wouldn't you consider the price of oil to begin to be affected by adoptions of wind and solar? Isn't their share of the pie increasing?
I think that, yes. I mean, I think these two points, George and April's points, are related, and they need to be taken together. We do see a spike, or at least some growth, in alternatives, especially wind and solar, and we see them in places that are often unexpected. I mean, of course, there's a move in some parts of the United States in this direction, but what's more interesting are European, as well as developments in the global south, where there are adoptions of alternative energy systems, Germany leading the way in Europe, but there are others elsewhere that are similarly progressive on this issue. And I think it gets back to something. We have a way of thinking about our relationship with big business. The big business, when confronted with either moral or material crises, environmental or social or otherwise, the big business needs to change its behavior for the common good. But that's not the way big business behaves. They have no incentive to do anything other than pursue profit. So what's really required, and I think what happened in those places that have accepted and adopted solar and wind, is that the state had to intervene. The state had to intervene in a way that required a kind of reconfiguration and a response. So the fact that the automobile industry that David talked about earlier has come to have a higher standard for emissions and for gas mileage, that's all the consequence of the government becoming more involved. I mean, we have to think critically about how uncomfortable we are with an interventionist state, with the reality that markets don't fix themselves, that it requires some kind of outside power. And we're at a moment with declining oil prices that there will be little other incentive for anybody to change their behavior. It's going to require somebody with the political authority to do so.
Hmm. It's so interesting. It seems like we take a step forward and then a step back when you're talking about getting rid of the 40-year oil export ban. And the Democrats said, well, if we can get credits for renewables, then we're going to go along with this because it's the only way we're going to get these credits.
It's an interesting balancing game. And, of course, everybody's under pressure to produce short-term results. And the problem, and I wrote this kind of flippantly at the end of the introduction of my newest book, the Running Dry book, the book which is really three essays on environmental politics in the U.S., that the problem is we're still stuck thinking we need a better oil policy. And the reality is we need a post-oil future. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any way to tinker our way out of this. It's going to require something dramatic. So a little step here at the cost of another little step there means we're more or less paralyzed and stuck in the status quo, and it doesn't get us anywhere.
Well, looking forward to solutions, Toby, we'd love to have you back to talk about your book, Running Dry. Toby Jones is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, and that book is Running Dry, Essays on Energy, Water, and Environmental Crisis. He's also author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Toby, thank you so much for joining us.
It was great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about efforts to oust the California Coastal Commission's executive director, Charles Lester. The four commissioners who want Lester out are not talking publicly, but insiders cite his management style. 35 former commission members and 76 environmental groups are defending Lester, calling the move a power grab by pro-development forces. So what's behind the potential shakeup, and who should decide the future of California's coastline? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.